Welcome back to the High Functioning Disaster, the show where we stop pretending it's all about better choices and actually talk about the messy wiring underneath our behavior. I'm your host, Sasha Holder. In the first part of my conversation with Jessica Setnick, we unpacked the idea of the inner eater, the younger version of you who learned about comfort, fear, safety, and connection through food, long before you had conscious control. In part two, we wade straight into the deep end. The food rules we absorbed, the body comments that stuck, the shame loops, the coping, the grief, and the way food quietly becomes a mood-altering chemical. Jessica and I talk about trauma that has nothing to do with food on the surface, but shows up through food anyway, and what it means to treat those patterns as information, not evidence that you're broken. If you've ever looked at your own eating and thought, "What's wrong with me?" this part of the conversation is going to offer a very different answer. Let's get into it.
We all kind of make up stories about what's wrong with us based on the experience we've had and how others reacted to us. And gosh, I wish someone would have told me a lot sooner that the way people react to us is so much more about them. And I had a revelation since we're, you know, I feel really comfortable with you and I can tell you things that, you know, are sort of random and you see how they tie together. I remember having this revelation. I was sitting on a plane and in front of me were two parents, and then on the other side of the aisle were two kids. So I could see the kids and I could hear the parents. And when we landed, the kids took off their seatbelts, and then the plane kind of lurched forward and the kids bonked into the tray, into the seat in front of them. And the dad lost his marbles and he started screaming at them. "When we get off this plane, you will be severely punished. Severely punished." I just remember his voice and his anger, severely punished. And it was this eye-opening moment to me that that dad was petrified that his kids were going to be hurt. And that's why he was screaming at them. It did not come across as the dad being scared for the kids. It came across as almost violent anger, almost the promise of violence. And the kids were crying. And I thought, this is on the parents. You chose to sit over there and put your kids over here. You could have split up and one kid sat with one parent and you could have managed their seatbelt. And this was your choice. And you're mad at yourself and you are screaming at your kids. It was just so eye-opening. I was probably in my 20s or 30s, but it was this revelation of, oh my God, parents yell at their kids when the parents are upset, when the parents are scared. I mean, it just, maybe it's so obvious to some people listening to this, but I'm telling you, that was new information for me.
As someone who doesn't have children, I can totally see how, you know, like that would be new information for you because, you know, it's not something that I have personally dealt with. And it makes sense. Like taking a step back, even for my own childhood, I can totally see how my, particularly my mom, reacted out of fear and I don't know if maybe negative emotions that she was experiencing within herself. I didn't really have that for my dad. I know that he was afraid. One time I was just messing around with some scissors and I pointed them at him and he told me not to do that. And so I did again, but just in a teasing way. And he barely tapped my hand like you might tap a toddler's hand when you want them to not do something after you've told them not to touch something. And that absolutely stunned me. I couldn't believe it, but then he explained later that he was terrified of sharp objects.
Oh. So you, without realizing, triggered something in him. Yeah. That's amazing that he told you that later, though, so you could kind of understand that. He was very insightful about that aspect of his experience.
Yeah, he told me that he was more afraid of a knife than a gun.
Wow. So he had had some kind of significant experience.
I would guess so, yeah. Mm-hmm. So that was really, I mean, I think I was 12. And so I didn't have the obviously fully developed brain and reasoning capabilities. But as an adult, looking back on that and thinking about it, like something like a knife, would I rather somebody pull a knife on me or a gun? I think I'd rather.
It wasn't even a knife. It was scissors.
I know, but like, would I rather? I think I would rather have the knife, but I'd really honestly rather have neither. But
right,
you know, if I had to choose, it's going to be the knife because I don't know. I just feel the opposite to him, but it's very interesting. But you know, I'm glad that, you know, it was maybe like 15 minutes or so later that he actually told me, I'm really afraid of.
That was a really a moment of vulnerability for him to tell you that he was afraid of something. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, and that means a lot to me today.
Mm-hmm. I didn't mean to interrupt you. As an adult, we have the perspective, like you said. So it's not bad to look back on these things as an adult because we do have a different point of view.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, perspective is everything. And like I was saying about when I was a child and I would ask for a dollar, like my perspective was so different compared to, you know, now I can step back and go, oh, well, maybe he needed all those dollars, like I said, or maybe he was afraid he would need an extra dollar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I can see the same perspective about my dad. Yeah. He was just a person who, I mean, my mom told me much later after my dad had died and we were talking about different things. She told me that he had told her when he was growing up, his dad would take him on a walk and they would get a toy that cost a penny. And he told my dad, you have to hide the toy from your mom. She can't know we spent a penny on the toy.
Oh, wow.
I mean, this is the Great Depression, right? This is like every penny is significant. Yeah.
Wow. So I want to shift to intergenerational food rules and body beliefs. So I'm curious, many of us grew up with messages like finish your plate, treats mean love. How do those rules shape us? And then can you speak about how they can be impactful to a post-op bariatric patient?
Okay, so multi-levels to your question. Let me think it through. When I think about the messages that we get about food in our bodies, the most significant thing to think about is we got them. We were given them. We did not grow up thinking our body is gross or our body is too big or we're no good. We aren't even born thinking I'm great, right? We don't have that thought at all. We don't even know we're separate as a human. We don't have that concept. We only know that we have needs and those needs are either met or not met. And from that, we develop our first, as I mentioned before, our first thoughts about whether I'm good or not, or, you know, acceptable, et cetera. What is really important to remember is that none of these things are innate. I mean, I believe that we're all born good, that the blank slate is good. Some people believe otherwise, and that's okay. But all the messages, every single thing you think about your body is something you inherited or were given or told, either from a person or from some kind of media you consumed. And that's really the key, I think, to addressing it before, during, after surgery. The idea that I get to choose what I want to believe rather than just being a vessel that passively accepts all of the messages that I'm given. And I think of it as being like clay, where if you are a person made out of clay and people throw things at you, maybe sticky, whatever it is, but it dents you. Right? Like everything that hits you kind of makes a mark. On the other hand, if you're made out of, like, I think of that blue plastic that racquetballs are made out of, that rubber, if you were made out of that, people could throw things at you and they'd just ping, bounce off. So we're trying to be a little more blue rubber than soft clay. But in our growing up time, we're soft clay completely. And so it's your choice. That's the most important thing I just want to get across to everyone, is that it is your choice which things to keep and which things to not keep. But the default path is keeping everything. And so you have to make the choice to look at it and then choose what you want to keep or not keep. And let me tell you, none of it is shameful. Absolutely not. And I know we have learned to be ashamed of all kinds of things, of our bodies, of parts of our bodies, the fact that our bodies smell, that we grow hair in certain places. And I would just like to say, think of all the industries that survive on body hate and body shame. If we liked ourselves as is, there's so many things we wouldn't need. If I was okay with frizzy hair, I wouldn't need any products for it. If we were all okay with getting wrinkles as we age, there'd be a whole industry that would die. You know, it's that kind of thing where we have to remember that people have motives for making us not like ourselves. And a lot of it is because they don't like themselves. And so even if our family members or the people who raised us were trying to protect us, right? Like a lady doesn't eat blank, or whatever they were saying, it was because they really believed those things and they wanted to protect us. But it's kind of like bullies saying, I'm doing this for your own good. They're still hurting you. And so we have to be able to look back and say, thank you for that information. I understand you were trying to protect me, but I'm going to do things differently now. And I have ice cream in my house all the time. And I don't always eat it, but I like knowing it's there. And when my husband brought home some subpar ice cream because the Bluebell was more expensive, I tried it and I said, N-O, I am going to get the more expensive Bluebell because we can afford it and I'm not eating this subpar ice cream, right? But I can acknowledge I was, you know, sort of shamed for wanting ice cream when I was a kid. And it feels better to me to have it there, even if I don't need to eat it. I'm not trying to get back at my dad. I'm just healing my inner eater. And I feel like, okay, after bariatric surgery, you might not be eating ice cream. So that might be an example that doesn't apply to you. But you can still look back and think about the messages that you got about food, about your body, and you can still assess whether you want to keep those or not.
Definitely, we have choices as adults, more choices and more agency than we do when we're small, when we're young. So can you share any examples of someone who rewrote a family food fairy tale and what that did for their daily choices?
Oh, that's interesting. Of course, I'm thinking about myself and the ice cream. Someone who rewrote it. Yes. So, well, another example is the person I mentioned who brings a beverage with them all the time. I am also thinking of someone who was in a workshop and said that through the course of the workshop, she realized she is accidentally passing on some really negative food messages to her daughters that were passed on to her, and she's decided to consciously change. And this is a lot of the work that we do when someone's child does have an eating disorder, is we look at what are the messages and asking people to change. And it's very hard sometimes to change. And so I would educate the whole family and say something like, okay, so we've recognized that it's really frustrating when XYZ happens. Oh, here, I'll give you an example. A family came to me and said they have a child that's a really picky eater and they have all kinds of problems because of it. And so in talking about it, one of the problems they identified was that if they have crescent rolls at dinner, which they all like, that this child would eat all of the crescent rolls because that was the only thing he liked on the table. And then there wouldn't be enough crescent rolls for anyone else. And this is a family with resources. This is not a situation where there's limited food. And so my suggestion was, what if you put two baskets of rolls on the table and this child is allowed to eat as many as he wants from one basket and the other basket is reserved for the rest of the family? And this idea was shocking to them. What? Make two packs of crescent rolls? I mean, isn't that the reason there's like eight in a pack? Because that's a serving, right? And you know, to help them recognize, like, actually, you can make 2 packs of crescent rolls and that's okay. And it's also nobody's business. Another example is someone who she would binge on Valentine's candy because she remembered that was something that her dad used to buy for her, is Valentine's candy. And she had a lot of unresolved grief and loss issues because her dad had died during surgery very unexpectedly. A well person that went into surgery and didn't come out. And she felt like she had done something wrong. And we were able to deduce that she wanted to stay connected with her dad. And so eating Valentine's candy helped when she was missing her dad. But then through therapy, she was able to recognize there are other ways to stay connected to her dad. She can also be sad of the loss of her dad. And none of those things really required her to eat excessive amounts of Valentine's candy. So those are just a few examples of people kind of changing the way they're thinking. And I think a lot of times it takes an outside person to sort of draw these lines or connect the dots, or at least writing them down, because you can't really solve a problem or even see it clearly with the same mind that created it. You almost have to think of it like, if my friend told me this was going on, how would I advise my friend, or something like that? So you can really think of it from a different perspective.
I can see how that is more, definitely more helpful than sticking with yourself, just reflecting internally, like, how do I, because it, you know, it's the same dialogue you have the with yourself. And so taking that shift in perspective and thinking about if it were someone else and not you, how would you help them? Mm-hmm. What would you do for them? Then that makes it different for yourself. So
it especially helps if you think about it as a child. What if a child mm-hmm. came to you? What if a child came to you and said, I'm hungry? Would you tell that child, you haven't earned your food by working hard enough? Or something mm-hmm. like that.
Going back to the person who was overeating the Valentine's candy mm-hmm. as a means of feeling connected with her dad, that grief is, it reminds me of when I was just like maybe a couple of weeks post-op from my gastric bypass surgery. I was really angry all the time, and I wasn't upset that I had surgery. I was glad that I did it, but I was so angry. And so I had an appointment with my bariatric office, and I said, you know, I think I need to see the social worker. And they were like, okay. So I had an appointment. I went to see her, and she asked me, you know, what's going on. And I was telling her how I feel angry all the time, but I'm not upset that I had surgery, and I'm not upset that I can't eat. And she said, oh, but that's grief. And I was like, but I'm not sad. And she said, it's still grief. You lost something. It's different now. And like, mind blowing, right? And then she handed me this piece of paper that had printed on it. It looked like a messy ball of yarn, and the different strands, how they looped around, had different emotions on them. And she said, you know, we're taught that grief is linear, that healing from, you know, loss, and that this path is linear, and it's not. You can feel any of these emotions at any time, and you can even feel multiple of them at any time. So, you know, essentially she's saying, give yourself grace. You lost something and it's okay. It's just going to take time. We don't know how much time, but and it's not a straight line. It's all over the place. And, you know, I felt so much better after that because I understood, and seeing that messy ball of yarn with all these different emotions on there was really eye-opening, because I was like, well, I feel that, and I feel that. So I wasn't just angry. I felt mm-hmm. all kinds of things.
Yeah, and I think of feelings as a roller coaster, right? I mean, Even the most balanced person has a lot of feelings in a day, right? When your feelings, when it's like a scary roller coaster, that's when you go talk to someone like you did. But every day is going to be a roller coaster of feelings. The problem from the healing your inner eater point of view is when your food gets on the roller coaster and now your food is, right, kind of scary, wacky, regretful versus your food and your feelings being separated. Sometimes they overlap a little bit, but when your food's on that messy roller coaster or mixed up in that ball of yarn, then usually we're not nourishing ourselves really appropriately. Either it's too much, too little, you know, too much of one thing, too spaced apart. You know, there's all kinds of reasons why we can let food interfere with our emotions and our emotions interfere with food. And some of it is because we may have been taught not to have certain feelings, that these certain feelings are not allowed. And so whenever we have them, we feel ashamed. Other times it's because we were given food when we had certain feelings and we learned that that was the way to cope with those feelings. And sometimes it's just the chemistry of it. Food is a mood altering chemical and we rarely think of it that way. But anyone who's been hangry and wants a divorce and then eats something and loves their spouse again, I mean, that happens to me all the time. You know, if you're hangry and you eat something and you feel better, well, it was food. Food was a mood-altering chemical. And we just don't recognize that fact very often.
I like the way that you use that terminology of mood-altering chemicals because, like, we know that sugar, particularly, is mood altering, and it does make us feel good in the moment, carbs in general. And to be clear, I'm never going to say that I don't have a where I eat my feelings, like that is something that I obviously did when I was a small child with bacon, but it's definitely a whole lot more difficult when your stomach is tiny. And I don't know if maybe that was part of my anger or not, but it's so interesting that food feels comforting. And how it can, my husband particularly, he loves food in a different way than anyone I've personally known before. He gets excited about different things. He loves comfort food. His grandmother was born in the 1800s, not his great grandmother, but his grandmother. And so she was a farm cook. So she made everything from scratch. And he, when he talks about this, his whole face lights up. And this is foreign to me because, like, I like food, but I don't like it this way. Like, it's not, it's almost like food is a love language for him. It's incredibly interesting. It's strange for me because I don't experience that. But it's also interesting because I have an incredibly high level of curiosity. So my brain's going, how is this so passionate for you?
What's
like,
on?
What makes it so passionate for you? But
did he love his grandmother too?
Oh, yes.
So it's a way of connecting with her, being interested in something that was interesting to her. Yeah.
Oh, yes. He's the youngest and, she called him the baby and spoiled him with her food. She would make things specially for him.
That makes perfect sense to me.
It's interesting.
Yep.
So how does trauma, whether food related or not, show up in the way that we eat?
Well, can I go back for a minute and just say something about your surgery, if you don't mind?
Yeah, absolutely.
Your surgery, you said you ate for feelings, then you had surgery, you can't eat for feelings. That means you're going to have the feelings. You're going to feel the feelings. If you were using food as a mood altering chemical and you don't have it anymore, then you're going to have the feelings that you are altering. So it's just important to recognize that there's two parts of food being a mood altering chemical. Excuse me, there's the food and there's the feelings. And there's nothing wrong with eating to modulate your feelings. It's not a moral thing. It's not a good or bad. It may not be congruent with your goals. But to me, I'm thinking of eating ice cream out of the container. Let's say that's a total cliche after a breakup, right? You see it in every rom-com, sitcom, whatever. Mm-hmm. Eating ice cream out of the container after a breakup. It's not wrong. It's not bad. It's not even, I don't know. It may not even be too much calories. It's nothing. It's not significant. It's just a way to maybe make yourself feel better, comfort yourself. The problem is if every Saturday night for the rest of your life, you're eating ice cream out of the container because of this breakup. Yeah, it may be too much ice cream, but to me, that's the least of the problems. The issue is this unresolved grief and loss about the breakup. And so food as comfort can point us to an area that needs healing. In other words, food can be the sign, the flashing light, the red flag that says there's something here that needs to be addressed. And when we just blame the food, oh, I eat too much ice cream, we're not allowing ourselves to recognize what the feeling is and heal the feeling. So there's that. Mm. Okay. Now, ask me your question again.
How does trauma, whether food related or not, show up in the way we eat?
Okay. So trauma changes brain chemistry. Trauma, ongoing stress, whether it's an event or an ongoing stress, changes brain chemistry. It saps out the good brain chemicals. And what makes the good brain chemicals come back? The things that we know of as mood-altering chemicals. Sex, drugs, alcohol, gambling, exercising, over-exercising, eating, not eating, throwing up. Those are the things that change our brain chemistry when it doesn't feel quite right. Oh, cutting, self-harm. And so when someone has a traumatic experience, even if it's unrelated to food, it can still affect their eating because they're self-medicating. And sometimes you hear someone talk about the way that they're eating as almost like they could be talking about anything. They could be talking about smoking a pack a day or something, kind of like, you know, I can't get through the day without it. There's just times in my day when I'm just having a craving and I have to step outside and get a smoke. You know, after a stressful meeting with my boss, I just, you know, really need a couple of cigarettes. You know, sometimes people talk about food in that same way. And it's really like, I can't think of a better word than self-medicating. And that's even if food wasn't involved in the traumatic event or the stress. If someone has a traumatic event that is related to food, and of course, the silly example I always think of is on Friends, where Chandler won't eat any Thanksgiving food because his parents at Thanksgiving told him they were getting a divorce, and now he won't eat any Thanksgiving food. But if a stressful event is related to food, it can be even more strongly linked together. Something with the food. I mentioned the granola bar incident for my patient. And if I had a marker board behind me, I would draw my traumamometer for you, but it basically looks like a thermometer. And if we said that, you know, the average stress in your day is like a 1 or a 2 on the traumamometer, and then like, you know, keeps going up and, you know, I don't want to trigger anyone, but like terrible things happening is like a 10. Your food can get involved in there too. And so for example, let me use the example of a flat tire. Okay, if a regular day of stress is 1 to 2, then a flat tire might be a 3 or a 4. That's really stressful. It's a very annoying thing in your day. If you get a flat tire on the way to a job interview, that's like a 6 or 7. If you get a flat tire when you were rushing to see your grandma before she takes her last breath and you don't make it because you had a flat tire, that's a 10. Okay, so the flat tire isn't the stressor as much as the environment in which it's happening can be the stress. So let's take a box of granola bars. To you, to me, granola bars might be no big deal. That's like a 0. That's a negative 10. There's boxes of granola bars in my cupboard right now. I don't care. But if someone was punished severely for eating a box of granola bars when it was the snack for the whole soccer team, that could be a 10. And so granola bars take on the energy, I don't know if that's quite the right word, of the traumatic event. Even though granola bars was very tangential to it. Even though the flat tire was very tangential to the job interview, now I am petrified of having a flat tire because it had that. I had that experience with a flat tire. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. It gets woven into your experience is all woven together, and so
relate. Woven together is a great way to describe it. And so if someone comes to me and says, I feel really strongly about bagels, or I feel really strongly about fish, you know, bacon, I'm going to guess that there is some kind of traumatic event, even if it's, let's say, as I don't want to minimize your experience, but let's say as every day as parents fighting, that was still registered on the trauma scale for you. Even if someone else would be like, your parents fighting, who cares? That happens every day, right? For you, that was a really difficult experience to process as a 2 or 3 year old. And so bacon takes on the emotion of the emotional experience.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about bacon and I'm just going, ugh, that's so gross. Oh, but this is wild. And I still think it was several weeks ago when we had our initial conversation and I realized about bacon. I still think that is really interesting and wild that I feel the way I feel about bacon. And it's probably because of that experience as a child and how I feel repulsed by bacon.
Yeah. And, you know, what's interesting is that it's unconscious until you bring it into your consciousness. And I can share an experience I had that was totally unconsciously driven. And it shocked me, too. The way you felt about bacon, that's how I felt about this experience. I was at the grocery store. It was my first paycheck as a working girl. I was so excited to go to the grocery store. I can buy whatever I want. I'm stocking my new apartment. And I saw this giant Mr. Good bar and I really wanted it. And I was just in this mindset of like, I can have whatever I want. And so I got this giant Mr. Good bar and I took it home, was unpacking the groceries, didn't want to eat the Mr. Good bar, just wanted it to be there. And it hit me like a ton of bricks. I was thinking, Mr. Good bar, really? Well, it turns out my dad's favorite candy was Mr. Good bar. It was really the only chocolate I ever saw him eat. And it suddenly hit me like a ton of bricks. Today is May 19th. This is my dad's birthday. And I was so wowed that this all happened completely out of my conscious knowledge.
Are you
there?
Did
I freeze? I'm here.
You
did.
Yes,
I'm here.
Yeah. So you were saying it was May 19th and then I lost you.
Okay. So it was May 19th, which is my dad's birthday. And so somehow unconsciously, I was trying to connect with my dad, but I didn't even consciously realize, like, I wouldn't even believe this story that I'm telling you if it hadn't happened to me. It hit me like a ton of bricks. I couldn't believe it that somehow this had all come together without my conscious knowledge. It was so wild.
That's incredible. And that you bought this ginormous Mr. Good bar, and that was his favorite candy bar, the only chocolate that you ever saw him eat.
Yes.
It's, and your subconscious was like, it's my dad's birthday. We got to celebrate.
Totally. Completely. Yes. Yes.
It is interesting how our subconscious mind works.
And I'll tell you, sometimes I get a little bit freaked out about it. Like, I don't like thinking that there's things going on that I have no knowledge of, no control over. It freaks me out a little bit. But then I remember I also have my lungs breathing without my conscious control and they're doing a good job. My heart's beating without my conscious control is doing a good job. When I scrape my knee, my scab and everything heals without me having conscious control. Like, it's okay. It's okay to get messages from your subconscious and just accept them as information and not be freaked out about it. It's just information. And then what we do with it is our choice. Now I choose to put May 19th on my calendar and do something celebratory every May 19th. So my unconscious doesn't have to do it for me. But it's not it's not bad to have all this stuff going on without our knowledge. It's just sort of a journey to investigate it and see what's there. If we can be curious, like you said, if we can be curious, that is the best sort of approach to look at it. Instead of like, it's embarrassing or I'm ashamed, just curious.
Yeah. And like I was saying about my husband, the way he feels about food, or I think the way he outwardly appears about food to be so passionate. Like I said, that is really weird to me. Like, that's strange. But instead of just shutting it down as strange and going, you're a weirdo, I'm like, but why? Tell me more, kind of thing.
Yeah. Yes. Yes, that is the eating disorder dietitian's greatest tool is tell me more. Yes. And I think of you and your husband, I'm picturing you as an anthropologist and you're like crouched behind a bush with binoculars, kind of like observing his culture. Just curious, that's just funny. Making notes in your notebook, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's okay that he's different from you. You're not judging it. You're just, you know, in observing.
That's a wrap on part two of my conversation with Jessica Setnick. And honestly, I hope you're being a lot kinder to yourself after hearing how much of this is wired in by experience, not character flaws. In part three, we shift from why am I like this to how do I live with this system and still advocate for myself? Jessica and I dig into why eat less, move more is not a nutrition assessment, and how weight stigma in healthcare actively harms people. Concrete scripts and strategies for speaking up at medical appointments, where surgery and medications fit alongside healing your inner eater, and how to start breaking the chain at home with no comment plates, body positive language, and simple rituals of gratitude for what your body can do. It's part rage, part relief, and a lot of practical support. See you next time. Oh, and one last thing. The content shared on the High Functioning Disaster is for informational and conversational purposes only and is not intended as professional, medical, or mental health advice. Everyone's situation is unique, and what we talk about here may not apply to your specific circumstances. Please do what's right for you and always consult with a qualified professional for medical, mental health, financial, or legal guidance. You take care of you, boo. See you next time.